Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. A few months ago, I went sifting through the Bay Area's naval history at the Alameda Naval Air Museum. I studied the displays of uniforms, mechanical models, photos, but there was one item I saw during my visit that boggled me. I'd never seen it before. It was the logo for WASPs, Women Air Force Service Pilots. During World War II, a group of female pilots were selected by the United States government to train to fly American military aircrafts. I'd never heard of the program until that moment. So, naturally, I went on the hunt for radio stories about these pilots, and was not disappointed. I'd like to start today's show with a collection of stories told by WASPs themselves and produced by the team at Radio Diaries.
Fastening my seatbelt. Throttle is set. Fuel pressure is fine. Okay, now we're going to start the engine. All clear. My name is Elizabeth Eyre Taylor, and we're in the Great Barrington Airport in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and I'm 79 years old. This is an Archer II, Piper Archer II aircraft. All right, now we're taxiing down the runway. It's a little cold, and we have a bit of a crosswind on takeoff. It's a bit windy today. Often when I go to the airport, their male pilots will come in and they see an old lady there, and they say, how long have you been flying? And I say, for 60 years. They say, 60 years? And I say, yes, I was a WASP. And they said, a WASP? What's that? Cherokee 062. Okay, we're ready to go.
My name is Libby Gardner, and I flew the B-26, the medium bomber, which is often referred to as the Widowmaker.
My name is Cady Landry Steele. I was assigned to the 369th Tow Target Squadron at Biggs Field, El Paso.
I'm Charlene Gregor.
I'm Ethel Meyer Finley.
My name is Louise Bowden Brown.
I'm Carol Bailey Bosca from Springfield, Ohio. I fell in love with every airplane that came along, like the P-51, the B-24s. I love the P-47. Oh, we all love to fly.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
They needed pilots. There weren't that many people that flew in 1940, period, you know. The Army only had about 1,800 pilots after Pearl Harbor, and they were needing millions.
I received a telegram in December of 1942 asking if I was interested in flying military aircraft. I didn't know anything about the WASP program.
There had been rumors about something like this, so I quit school and started to work at the airport so that I could build up my flight time so that I could qualify for the program.
At that time, there were some over 3,000 women who had a private license or more, and they start going down the list.
And I started reading this telegram, and then on the bottom it said, you will, it didn't say we'd like to have you, you will report to the Statler Hotel on such and such a date and such a time for an interview. And I thought, my God, I've been drafted.
This is Texas, cradle of our Army's Air Force. This is an AAF field, too, and out of those buses are stepping girls. Girls who give a new angle to an Air Force story. Everywhere they're badly needed for ferrying duty so that the men can go off to fight, while WASPs help get their ships started on the road overseas. They're WASPs, Women's Air Force service pilot.
Dear Mommy, the first day, it's really a lot different than I thought it would be. It's a big field with lots of airplanes. Man, oh man, think of the money we're costing Uncle Sam. It is still in the experimental stage. They are still quite doubtful of women pilots. We were supposed to be in bed by 10 o'clock and up in formation at 6:45, and that is all I know so far. We find out the rest hour by hour tomorrow.
The trainees live in barracks, six to a bay. They're civilians, but under Army discipline, so everything is strictly GI. They must go through the same rigorous training given any soldier. Up at 6, and a hard day ending long after the Texas sun has set.
Sweetwater, Texas is the most godforsaken place. I mean, just dust, sagebrush, and dirt, and
mesquite, and rattlesnakes, and even at night, it's as hot as hell. Excuse my English.
And here are all these women from different walks of life. Millionaire heiresses like Florsheim Shoes, Upjohn Drug Company, and then you had poor kids like me from the farm. And everybody was in the same boat, had the same ill-fitting clothes. You know, you arrived in your own clothes, but then you would report to supply, thinking, well, should I order 10 or a 12? And the sergeant behind the desk could say 42 or 44.
Flight suits we were wearing were for men.
I mean, it was enormous. Enormous. You know, it was just enormous in every direction. Mine stood by itself.
We'd have to get up in the morning, we'd march to the flight line, everybody would be singing.
They'd say, fall in, and we'd all fall in, and they'd say, hip up, march, and we'd march to wherever we were going. And I wasn't in the habit of having seen yesterday every shave tail that came along, some of them even younger than I, and some of them pretty stupid. I thought, this is a big mistake, until we got started in the airplanes.
Next comes the training flight. Oh, let the motor roar. Each flying student is required by Army regulation to don a parachute.
And you go out and you put this big parachute on and climb up into the airplane. You have to put your goggles and your helmet. We had to wear fur-lined jackets, fur-lined pants, and fur-lined boots, because we were in an open cockpit and it was cold. It was in the wintertime. So we'd climb in, and then an instructor would take you up, and then he'd say, okay, honey, I'm going to show you how to do a slow roll. He said, fasten your seatbelt, make sure it's fastened. So you fasten your seatbelt.
With the student at the controls, the instructor in the rear seat directs her in the finer points of flying military planes in a military way, with tricky maneuvers.
First time you do that, and he turns you over upside down, your arms fall out and your legs fall out and all the dirt falls out of the plane, and you're just hanging there on the seatbelt. And often you would see this white thing floating down to the ground because somebody had forgotten to fasten their seatbelt, and there would some girl be floating down to the ground with her parachute.
I'll tell you, the first time I flew an AT-6, tears rolled down my cheeks. I just thought, well, I'll never master this. It's too much for me. Take me back to the farm. But anyway, you get over it. It's a funny thing, but you do.
No longer are they the rookies of 6 months ago, but a smooth and well-disciplined detachment. Now the WASPs are ready to go to work and do a job that has delighted all the Air Force officials. Good weather and bad, they fan out to various bases in California, Texas, Delaware, Michigan.
We did a lot of odd jobs that they didn't want to waste a man on.
Ferrying planes, testing planes, flying officers around, towing targets.
We were in a tow target squadron. Our main mission there was training these boys at Fort Bliss in anti-aircraft, because they were going to go overseas and try to shoot the enemy planes out of the sky. And to learn how to do that, they had to have somebody up there flying these targets for them to shoot at. And we were the duck.
Now, guns ready, they practice on a target towed by a plane.
You know, they were shooting live bullets at the target. And one night we were towing in a B-26, and the flak started bursting in front of us. And the target was behind us. So we had to take some evasive action to get out and call the ground forces and told them that we are not completing this mission. We're rolling in our target and going home. We'll come back tomorrow and see if you can shoot any better.
Most of what we did was very monotonous. Those searchlight missions, we were up there at night flying these patterns, flying 45 degree angle to the right, 180 degree turn, 45 degree angle. For 4 hours we're doing this. 18 to 21 year old men are not very good at that because they're all hot dogs. But women have been trained all their life to do repetitive jobs. You do the dishes, you know, three times a day, you make the beds every day. We're used to that kind of thing. And if we got some that were fun, like the strafing and so on, that was just enough to keep us stimulated, you know. We didn't have to be flying under bridges or up box canyons all the time.
I will admit that some months into it, I began to be a little bored with flying around in a rectangular pattern.
The older men didn't think we could fly the airplanes. They didn't think we were strong enough. They didn't, I don't think they trusted us.
I would have gone into combat any minute. For the simple reason, I think if I'd have had some training, I think I probably would have been pretty good at dogfighting.
In mass production in the United States is the B-29 Super Fortress, the largest, fastest, and most powerful bomber ever built.
It was 1944 in July. And the B-29 was going to be the biggest and the best bomber in the world. It was made for the long range. Nobody, of course, knew anything about it, any atomic bombs or anything at that point, but it would be the aircraft that would allow us to win the war in the Pacific. And that's why they were very anxious to get this into the inventory. But it had experienced some engine fires, and they were having these problems at the training bases with people who were reluctant to fly it. Each airplane had its own reputation, and they did not want the B-29 to have a bad reputation. And there was a man named Colonel Paul Tibbetts. He had the idea that if he could get two women to fly this, that he could take them to the training bases of the B-29 and show the men that it was so easy to fly, even a woman could fly it. That's how he chose the two of us. It was an awe-inspiring feeling, the power that you could feel in those engines. It was like flying an apartment house, practically. I forget what the wingspan is, 144 feet, I think. But when you're flying, it felt so easy compared with what I thought it would feel like. It was easy to turn it. It was easy to climb it. It was easy to even stall it. It was a dream ship. I had no problem at all. And the word spread all over. My gosh, there are two women flying this thing.
The worst thing that happened to me, we were in fighter school and my roommate was killed. She was flying formation in an AT-6 and she was in the back seat. Her instructor was up front. And she was in the middle of a formation of three airplanes. And the fellows behind her must have taken their eyes off the other wing, and their wing went through her hatch and hit her on the head and knocked her out. And her instructor couldn't raise her, so he bailed out. And she went in with the airplane. I had to take her body home to New York State from Brownsville, Texas. I had to tell her parents. I did not like that job.
38 women were killed in either training or assignments. Evelyn Sharp out in Oklahoma, that was an engine failure of P-38. There was one out of Shawfield. She was out testing a BT-13. They found her. She had crashed. Some of them were pilot error, and some were engine problems, and some were collisions. And it was rather a sobering thing, but I don't know that it affected anybody's desire to go out right away again.
Wars aren't very much fun. We were all losing our relatives, our boyfriends, our husbands, our brothers, and it just made everybody want to do as much as they possibly could to win the war and get it over with. But in the meantime, we were enjoying it.
You must understand that we love to fly. And that was built in every single one of us.
A lot of times you're by yourself. And to be up there by yourself, flying.
And you can just fly around and look around or play hide and seek in the clouds.
And then sometimes I'd fly and have cumulus clouds all around me, and I'd be pretending I'm New York City and going down all the high rises along the side were clouds.
We just felt we had really won a prize to get to fly these airplanes, which were off limits for us in any ordinary way, and to get paid for doing it, and to know that we were contributing to the war effort. It's just too much. Very few men ever got a chance like that, and here we were getting this chance.
We had the best airplanes in the world, the best instructors in the world. We had it made. And then all of a sudden, the Army says, we don't need you anymore.
To each member of the WASP, I am very proud of you young women. You have freed male pilots for other work. But now the war situation has changed, and the time has come when your services are no longer needed. If you continue in the service, you will be replacing instead of releasing our young men. I know that the WASP wouldn't want that. So I have directed that the WASP program be inactivated and all WASP be released on the 20th of December of 1944. My sincere thanks and happy landings always. H.H. Arnold, Army Air Force.
General Henry H. Arnold of the Army Air Forces.
There was a huge crowd there. General Arnold made the primary speech, and it was a wonderful send-off.
Frankly, I didn't know in 1941 whether a slip of a girl could fight the controls of a B-17 in heavy weather. Now, in 1944, it is on the record that women can fly as well as men.
At the end of the ceremony, we all marched down. Of course, we all had our hair up. We were looking real nice. And then we sang the song. We're the last class of Avenger Field. It was a whole day of celebration. And then the next day, we all packed and left the field. Went home.
It was December 20th, 1944, and that's when we left. It was sad. It was really sad. I knew that I would never, never get in those airplanes again.
Santiago blue and a heart that's true, and we ain't gonna be here much longer.
Two of the girls went up to Alaska and became bush pilots. Some found jobs in charter services. They dusted crops. They taught other people to fly. But they were the real exception. There just were not jobs for women as pilots.
Not only the WASP, but all the other women that took part in the war effort, the women that manned the factories, the women that ran the farms, the women that built the ships, they all lost their jobs because the men came back. After the war, we went right back where we were. We were supposed to be home and have children and raise families, and we weren't supposed to be flying airplanes. We weren't supposed to be doctors and lawyers and engineers and all those things. We were before our time.
If you have a daughter, teach her how to fly. If you have a son, throw the bastard in the sky, singing zoot suits and parachutes and wings of silver too. He'll ferry airplanes like his mommy used to do.
25,000 women applied, 1,837, I think, were accepted for training, and 1,074 graduated.
It doesn't seem real to me sometimes, you know, that I actually did that. If you were out in a crowd in a social conversation, someone said, "Do you remember World War II?" And you said, "Oh, yes, I flew for the Air Force." And they went, "Come on, don't be ridiculous. They didn't have any women in the Air Force."
Great Barrington Airport, Cherokee 062. I'm flying at 1,200 feet. The airspeed is 60. We have a crosswind from the left. Turning on to our final approach right now. About to land, we hope. Whoa! And we're back home again in one piece.
Sometimes I have dreams that when I'm flying, B-25s, B-26s, P-47s, and all those beautiful, you know, warbirds. I mean, I think it's funny because I haven't flown for so many years, and it seems strange to me that at 85, be dreaming about flying airplanes. Very often we can get a chance to ride in one of these airplanes that we used to fly. I don't want to ride in one. I don't want to ride in another AT-6 or a B-25. I want to remember it like it was when I did it. I think it's much more real to me and much more enjoyable to me to remember the way it was.
That was produced by Joe Richman and Teal Kreck of Radio Diaries, with Shelley Preston and Ben Shapiro, and editorial support from Deborah George. Listen to dozens more stories from Radio Diaries by subscribing to their podcast or listen to their backlog at radiodiaries.org. You're tuned to The Spot, KALW's weekly showcase of the best stories made by indie radio producers and podcast producers. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. After soaring so high in that last piece, I'm not ready to come down yet. Let's go even further into our atmosphere. Let's actually leave it all together. In 1983, Sally Ride became the first American woman to enter space. While much has changed in the 30-plus years since Ride made history, her unearthed interview with Gloria Steinem, as part of Steinem's then-ABC series, In Conversation With, highlights the fact that some things sadly haven't changed. From the PBS series and podcast Blank on Blank, here's an edited version of that original television interview.
I wish that there had been another woman on my flight. I wish that two of us had gone up together. Mm-hmm. I think it would have been a lot easier.
It's tough to be the first, but you've done it with incredible grace. You also have the only job in the world that everybody understands.
My father, I think, was so grateful when I became an astronaut because he did not understand astrophysicist. He couldn't relate to that at all. But astronaut was something he thought he
understood.
But astronaut,
and you could see people all over the world connecting with what you were doing.
Roughly half the people in the world would love to be astronauts, would give anything to trade places with you, and the other half just can't understand why in the world you would do something that stupid.
If you don't have 20/20 vision, can you become an astronaut candidate? I always thought that was a big disabling factor.
I think it used to be. Now, as long as it's correctable to 20/20, it's okay. So you'd probably qualify. I didn't have any dreams about being an astronaut at all, and I don't understand that, because as soon as the opportunity was open to me, I jumped at it, and I instantly realized that was what I really wanted to do. I took all the science classes that I could all the way through junior high school and then into high school. I went to a girls' school that really didn't have a strong science program at all when I was there. At the time, it was a classic school for girls with a good tennis team and a good English teacher and essentially no math past 11th grade and no physics and no chemistry.
I'm curious about the reception that you got inside NASA. Well, what kind of thing happened to you?
Really, the only bad moments in our training involved the press. The press was an added pressure on the flight for me, and whereas NASA appeared to be very enlightened about flying women astronauts, the press didn't appear to be. the things that they were concerned with were not the same things that I was concerned with.
They For instance, the bathroom facilities.
Bathroom facilities.
How much did you get asked that?
Just about every interview I got asked that. Everybody wanted to know about what kind of makeup I was taking up. They didn't care about how well prepared I was to operate the arm or deploy communication satellites.
Did NASA try to prepare you for the press and the pressure?
Unfortunately, no, they don't. You know, in my case, they took a graduate student in physics who had spent her life in the basement of a physics department with oscilloscopes and suddenly put me in front of the press.
What do you suppose are the dumbest kinds of questions you've been asked to date?
Without a doubt, I think the worst question that I have gotten was whether I cried when we got malfunctions in the simulator. No.
That surpassed even the one about whether you're going to wear a bra or not? Did somebody really ask you that?
No. The press, I think, decided that that was a good question for someone to have asked me and for me to have answered, but I never got that
And they
question.
Made up your they made you up quite a good response. Something about in a state of weightlessness, it doesn't matter. Or
yeah, I think
they
it
made
was
up this whole
it
thing.
Was something like that. Yeah, I was never asked that question.
What about your feelings during the launch? Was there any time that the enormity of what was going on came over you?
The moment of the launch, when the engines actually ignited and the solid rockets lit, everyone on the crew was, for a few seconds, just overcome with what was about to happen to us. But a year of training is a long time. A year of sitting in simulators and being told exactly what's going to happen, and you hear the sounds and you feel the vibrations, and they prepare you very well, and it worked. We were able to overcome being overcome and do the things that we were supposed to do.
Just watching there at the launch, there were people with tears streaming down their faces. People I never would have expected. And yet they were all very moved by, I guess, the human audacity of it.
I think that to imagine when you see the long trail of flame and then imagine that there are really people inside that, that's really something. Inside, of course, you don't see the long trail of flame, and what you're feeling is really more of an exhilaration.
Well, there are lots of people looking up there feeling proud, not only of you up there, but also on the ground. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sally Ride, first American woman in space, talking with feminist and writer Gloria Steinem. This interview comes from the huge archive dedicated to the life and work of Gloria Steinem, the Gloria Steinem Papers, part of the Sophia Smith Collection at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. Thanks again to them. This episode is part of our Science and Innovation series, The Experimenters. You can watch the animated version of this episode on our website, blankonblank.org. That's all for now. Thanks so much for listening.
If you'd like to hear more archival interviews, subscribe to Blank on Blank on iTunes or Stitcher, and watch their video series on YouTube. That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at kalw.org. Look under the Programs tab. I love listening to your suggestions, so please take a moment and share some of the podcasts you've really liked lately. Email me at thespot@kalw.org. And tune in next Thursday, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on KALW San Francisco.